Let's get physical, physical. Let me hear your body talk, Dave. All this and more coming up on This Week in Retro.
High resolution color graphics.
This land of high technology.
The revolution in technology that made the information age possible.
Those kids are not afraid of computers.
EA, it's in the Steam.
Japan loves retro.
And VHS down under.
These stories and a whole lot more coming up on This Week in Retro.
Up-to-date news for out-of-date tech.
Hello, Dave. It's the pre-show chat bit, which is part of the show, but kind of pre the show.
Yes, that's what pre-show means.
Is it?
Yes.
I thought that was the chat we had before we pressed record.
Well, yes, nobody hears that. We don't let Duncan hear that.
That's the pre-show chat, the stuff that's too hot to do before we press record.
Well, we're talking about black versus chrome. There's nothing really exciting.
We were talking about arcade restorations, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you didn't miss out on anything, don't worry. We're into the meat of it now, into the interesting stuff, which is what Dave's done this week. What have you been up to,
this
Dave?
This week I've been shopping on eBay for a change.
Oh, I saw you toying with the idea of buying these, and you said, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to go down another rabbit hole. And then they arrived. What are they?
These are three Puffin books. So Puffin is the part of the Penguin Publishing, and they are the Zork Adventures.
Mm. Are they choose your own adventures?
Well, yes, they are. Although they're not called choose your own adventures, of course. They're called something else. They were called something else in the USA, and I can't remember what it was. Mm-hmm. You decide what happens.
You decide what happens. It's not the catchiest name, is it?
I mean, it's a knockoff. But there's three of them. The Zork Adventures. There's the Forces of Krill, the Malefestro Quest, and the Cavern of Doom, and they've got the wonderful cover art, hand-drawn cover art of the day. They're based in the Zork universe. They're written by Eric Moretzky, so they should be decent.
When were they released? What year?
These are early 80s.
Okay.
So these are right in the kind of the period of Zork. There was Zork. Four of them, I believe, but only three of them released in the UK.
Zork for people who couldn't afford a computer.
Oh, yes. First published in the USA in 1983.
The equivalent of one of those little LCD games of Street Fighter 2 if you didn't have a computer, but you can't
do that
in the text adventure.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, but when these came out, I was right into the fighting fantasy books, which were, I think, better than Choose Your Own Adventure.
They were great.
I didn't know about these. Zork was the kind of gold standard in text adventures. So these will be interesting. They're not very big. I imagine they'll not occupy me for too long, but I think I'll really enjoy them.
Was it the gold standard, or was it just the first to make a big impact, the first commercially available one, and therefore it stuck?
It continued to sell loads and loads. I think the later games were better games, but it was the one everyone knew about.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing that, you know, the word Zork has sustained its reputation for nigh on 50 years. 40 years.
Yeah, and if you were playing Zork if in 1980 you were playing Zork, you wouldn't be 8 or 10 years old. You'd have to be a bit older, I think. Mm. So you would be a generation older than you, Neil, and a bit older than me.
Well, you could say the same about Leisure Suit Larry, Dave, but that didn't stop me.
Yeah, it's true. That's true.
You played what was available to you, didn't you?
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, this week I've been playing more with Exodus. I've been trying all the different ways of running it because I still want to set up a museum computer, a museum in a box, if you like, with Exodus on there. I tried running it from my NAS because there's lots of storage space on there. It works, but it wasn't too happy about running across the network after a long time setting up because it does lots of decompression to set up. So I've got it on some spinning disks now, a couple of 2 terabyte disks mirrored, and it's very happy there. And I'm really enjoying it at the moment going through the filters and playing games with MT32 support and just listening to the music on all of those. Really nice. It is a reminder because when I think of PC gaming, I think of lush, expensive, premium big box games. But I am back into the realms of too much choice and being reminded that there's a lot of dross as well because this is the complete DOS library. Yeah. There's a lot of dross in there. There's a lot of budget games that I didn't realize also came out on PC. I was familiar with them with the 8-bits and with my Amiga, but there they are. There's lots of games from the pre-VGA era and It takes a lot to suck me into a game that's pre-VGA. That's really the turning point. We've spoken about this, haven't we? How that affected us.
And all made of a sudden, the doors were open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you present me with a very magenta game, it's going to have to be something really special. And that's perhaps why I like looking at the ones with things like MT32 support, because I can go in and I can go, right, this is something above and beyond what I was experiencing at that time, even if it's just the music, and I'm going to enjoy that, Dave.
Yeah, I should explain to our listeners that MT32 is a Roland sound module, and it was quite expensive. It was out of reach for people like us at the time.
It was a musician's product.
Yeah, yeah, but it made the sound on these games fantastic. And I wonder if having MT32 sound is a little kind of indicator that a lot of effort has gone into a game, and that if it's got MT32 sound, it's probably better than just some kind of shovelware that was made in a hurry and pumped out quickly.
Possibly, yeah, because, yeah, they didn't rush it out the door. They took the time to add that support. So I will continue exploring Exodus and my quest to create an Exodus museum box for people to enjoy, and work out if I need to then curate that or if I need to stick to the whole point of Exodus, which is there's everything, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
I wonder if you can do some kind of favorites thing with some kind of white listing of the games that you would suggest people look through,
perhaps
rather than present them with the endless pages of rubbish.
Yeah, perhaps my choices and sort of genre defining games, and something I've been talking about for the rest of the museum, implementing NFT so that you could take a box from the from the fake shop and tap it. Something we're seeing a lot more of happening. Hopefully we can make it happen in the museum as well. Anyway, that's what my week's been. You got anything else you want to throw in there before we get into this week's stories, Dave?
No. Let's get right into it, Neil.
Let's get physical.
The other week, and just a few minutes ago, we were talking about Exodus making games accessible to people, opening the door to people playing these old games who would struggle to do so otherwise. You've got it working now, Neil. So I'm pleased to hear that.
So I'm laughing because I had a note in the show notes to say I've got it working, but we already talked about that.
Yeah.
Dave took a breath to let me say I've got it working because I have got it working. Yes. Carry on, Dave.
It seems that EA, Electronic Arts, are doing a bit of that themselves. I noticed LGR on Twitter that one of the games that he's just done a fantastic retrospective review of, SimCity 3000, I noticed him saying it's on Steam now, but it's not the only game to appear there. There's Command & Conquer Ultimate Collection, SimCity 3000 Unlimited, Populous, Populous 2, Populous 3, Dungeon Keeper, Dungeon Keeper 2, Sid Meier's Alpha Centauri, and The Saboteur. Now, I've played and enjoyed all but two of those games. Populous 3 or Populous the Beginning, I bounced off. I didn't enjoy it. I haven't gone back to it. And The Saboteur, I've never played. And to be honest, I've never heard of until now. The rest are stone-cold classics, absolute top-class, wonderful games. The best out of the best there. I do know Populous and Populous 2 from the ST, and I presume you'll know them from the Amiga, but I had a look, and the DOS ports seem to be fine.
Saboteur makes me think of the 8-bit game from, was it Jurel Software published it, where you're the guy coming in on your speedboat, sneaking in. That's all I think of when I think of Saboteur. Yeah. But that was way earlier. Yeah, I was obsessed with Populous, Command & Conquer, SimCity. I have to admit, SimCity peaked for me. And when I say peaked, I mean the hours I put into it, not necessarily the series peaked, in SimCity 2000. I didn't really give 3000 the time of day when it came out in 1999, because that was the year of Unreal Tournament. So very few other games got a looking for me that year. And, of course, we were all about the 3D. We hadn't quite got back to accepting 2D games can be premium AAA games. We were turning our noses up a little bit. And how wrong we were, because SimCity 3000 is a wonderful game. And I need to give it more time. So do I play it on Steam, Dave, or do I play it in Exodus? Where do I go to try this out? What's the done thing?
Steam or Exodus, either you choose. Yeah. It's not up to me to tell you how to do it.
I thought
either will be fine.
The arbiter of all things piracy, Dave.
No, that, you're referring to a comment, aren't you?
I am, yes.
tell our listeners what the comment is.
Yeah, there's a comment here from last week's show, Dave. It says, even Mr. Piracy Scottish Man balked at the thought of the million download thingy. Mr. Piracy Scottish Man, you will be known as from now on. And that was from listener LBF5677.
I don't know what to say to that. So moving on from that, because I've got nothing to say. The Saboteur is a weird one. I don't really see how it fits. It's a 2009 game. So in my book, that's an up-to-date current new release. All of the rest of them are from last century, although several of them are later releases, including expansion packs, all released together after Y2K.
Oh, when you say last century, that really does make things sound old.
I know. It's a weird way of saying it. It also turns out that most of these are already available on GOG.com. And to be honest, that's the first place I would go when buying games, because I know that they come without DRM and it feels easier to get the files. I've quite often bought games that I've got the physical version of on GOG because they come patched and sorted out. And sometimes that's an easier way to play them than using originals. I can still get the actual manuals and the box out, but have it digitally there for me.
Yeah, given the choice, it's nice to know that if you've downloaded that game and you've archived it off to your NAS and you've installed it and you're playing it, you know, when you upgrade your computer, when you change something, you can just copy that folder and you can play it. That's always more appealing than thinking it's all entirely dependent on an online service. So, yeah, it's always first choice.
Yeah, I would imagine you can do that. You can install it in Steam and take it out somehow, but I'm not entirely confident in that. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not sure. I can't find anything to say if these games are packaged any differently to GOG. So if they're enhanced or more optimized for DOSBox, if they've done any extra work on them. I don't expect that they are, but I'm guessing. And it also marks EA moving perhaps a little bit away from their EA platform, formerly known as Origin, which they took the name from a wonderful studio that I'm sure many of us still mourn. Neil, what famous game series did Origin produce?
Oh, get ready, Duncan. Wing Commander?
Yes. Anything else? No.
Space Rogue.
System Shock.
Yeah.
Does this indicate there's going to be less exclusives around? I do hope so if they're moving things on to Steam. And interesting, though, also indicates that EA have a focus on their older properties.
Ultima.
You couldn't keep it in, could you? Oh, it burst out.
Carry on.
Ultima. Interesting, though, also indicates EA have a focus on the older properties. These games are wonderful. They're not priced highly either, and I think for the most part they've aged extremely well. But is this an indication that EA sees some real value in these? And does it bring me back to think about Exodus again? Because these games will be popular on that, and EA is currently selling them. But going through the games themselves, Command & Conquer, I played enough of that to get fed up with it, because they kept releasing expansion packs and sequels. SimCity 3000, I played SimCity 2000 more than 3000. I think I satisfied myself with SimCity on 2000, and with 3000 came out was another things. Populous, though, and Populous 2 are wonderful, fantastic games. They are god games. You can play them for hours without noticing how much time's passed. Dungeon Keeper and Dungeon Keeper 2 are really fantastic charm games. They've got a lot of satirical, a lot of humour in them. You take on the role of a dungeon keeper and heroes come and attack your dungeon. You have to kill them. And Sid Meier's Alpha Centauri is the best of the Civilization games, in my opinion. It's got a lot more depth than the Civilization games. I come back to it more often than any other Civilization game now. So there's lots of absolutely wonderful games there. Neil, which one would you play first?
Well, it's an interesting list. We've got games and we've got sequels to games. And I've always had a bit of an affliction to sequels. It takes a lot to get me to revisit a game if I've invested a huge amount of time into a game. For example, Populous, hundreds of hours put into that game. So you almost feel a kind of fatigue when a sequel comes out and think, well, do I want to start that again? I don't know if any of our listeners have that same problem as me. It's something that comes up time and time again. So I've played a lot of these games and I haven't played a lot of the sequels to these games. I'm surprised some of these haven't been released as packs. One of them has. Command & Conquer is a collection there. But others, for example, you could have the Populous pack, you could have the Dungeon Keeper pack. And that adds a little bit more curation to the whole thing on Steam rather than just selling the individual games. That being said, if you want to buy Dungeon Keeper on Steam right now, it's £2. It's saying it's reduced from £4.99. Come on, £2. Pocket money prices. Less than we used to pay for a budget game because it's the same price without the inflation added on. £1.99 we used to go out and buy a game for. £2 here for a previously, or still arguably, AAA game. It's just a little bit old, but there's definitely £2 of value in there. So it's good to see. It's always nice to see retro games made more available. It doesn't have to be in one outlet. It's good that it's on GOG and on Steam and wherever else it might pop up. However, again, looking at the Dungeon Keeper page on Steam, the game page also encourages me to subscribe to something called EA Play for £3.99 a month. And it says that Dungeon Keeper is included in this subscription. Have you come across EA Play before, Dave?
No, and it's something I wouldn't even click on out of interest. I'm not that particularly interested, but I'm having a look now to see what's included in there, if it's just a retro thing. No, it's not.
EA Play is a package that gives you access to a library of games on Steam for a monthly fee instead of buying and downloading the games individually. It's still digital, but I think you feel like you have a bit more ownership over those ones and zeros when you buy the games individually. Whether it's on GOG or on Steam. So, yeah, subscription services within Steam. It's in EA's interest to make Play sound like a good value proposition, and you do that by saying it's £3.99 a month and you get access to 5,000 games. I don't know how many games it is. I'm just going to say 5,000. So is doing this an easy way to bump up that number? If we start shoveling retro games into EA Play, it brings that number up, and on the surface, it tells people that you get more value for money for your £3.99 a month. And you're seeing familiar and trusted brand names like Dungeon Keeper, like SimCity, like Command & Conquer. Could that be it? Am I being too cynical? But is that part of the whole equation?
I mean, I guess they're trying to present you the thing, oh, buy this game for £3 or subscribe for £3.99. You're thinking, well, I'll subscribe for £3.99 or £4.99, whatever it is. They do too. I've just checked. They do EA Play, which you can get on Steam, on PlayStation, on Xbox, and on the EA app. And also in the EA app, they do Play Pro, which is much more expensive. And I guess Play Pro is their equivalent of the Xbox Game Pass or all the rest of it, PlayStation, whatever their Game Pass is. And the EA Play is kind of a little... well, you're going to buy this game for less than the cost of that, so why not subscribe onto it? I'm not going for that at all. I have no interest in doing that either. I want to buy the game, own the game, and then not have to pay a subscription for it.
The future of gaming looks very much like the current position of streaming films, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
End up with so many services that you don't have to, but if you want to play certain games, you have to subscribe to them all.
Yeah.
Long live retro.
Yeah, so I'm not saying use Steam, I'm not saying don't. I'm just happy to be talking about some of my most favourite games and them being accessible to play right now. So play more in 24.
Our show this week is not sponsored by a very noisy cat with you there, Dave. Which one's making all that noise?
That's Dot making the noise in a very different room. She's in the kitchen meowing. I don't know why, and Johnny's just gone off to investigate.
Does Johnny look after Dot?
No,
big brother. No.
No, okay. Johnny once left alone by Dot, and Dot is always trying to bother Johnny.
Okay. Well, we're not sponsored by either of those, but we are sponsored by Pixel Addict magazine. Very kindly support the show and have done for some time now. And they've got a new copy of their weekly, six weekly, monthly magazine out, haven't they, Dave?
No.
No?
It's not out yet. The one we're going to talk about is not out for a few days until after this is broadcast.
It ships from the
21st of March.
Are we looking at issue 19? Are you still on 18?
No, we're looking at issue 19, which is out on the 21st of March.
Okay, and that's the one with Tandy, the story of an electronics giant on the cover.
Yes.
Lots of TRS-80s.
Yeah, we've talked about Tandy as in the past. They're great.
Do you know what Tandy makes me think of?
What?
Radio controlled cars.
Yeah, yeah. Browsing in a shop that you know you're not going to buy anything in.
Yeah.
They also have a review of the 2600 Plus, and they've got a retrospective look at the 2018 movie Rampage that I didn't see. That I'm going to assume is rotten.
Sounds yeah, just the thought of it sounds awful. They've also got a 40-year retrospective of the King's Quest series, which famously started out on the IBM PC Junior.
So yes, that'd
be an interesting one to read about.
You can subscribe to them at their website, Neil.
You can, yeah.
And you can also buy issues to be delivered physically. You can subscribe to physical issues as well. You get them, get back issues too at their website, Neil.
You can, yeah.
Yeah. Do you happen to know what the website is?
I do. You can get back issues, you can get forward issues, and you can get current issues at pixel.addict.media.
Thank you for sponsoring us.
Thank you, guys. Our next story is submitted by Paul, a.k.a. Pajaco6502, who takes us to the land of the rising sun and a retro revival. The Japan Times reports that retro gaming is getting ever more popular over there, with retailers launching multiple new consoles, which are specifically Nintendo NES compatible, or as it would be over there, Famicom compatible. But there's no sign of Nintendo suing here. It says in the story that second-hand retailers Book Off Group Holdings and Geo Holdings have separately developed new consoles, and that the game reselling market is flourishing both in stores and online.
So are these like the Atari 2600 Plus? Are they designed for original NES cartridges to go into?
They are. So these are new consoles that sell for under £20. I haven't seen a picture, so I don't know if they're mini or if they're original size, but then the original Famicom wasn't exactly a large console in the first place, so it'd be fine if it was normal size. Priced under £20, that is an impulsive purchase. If you're feeling a little bit nostalgic on that particular day, there's nothing to stop you chucking it in your shopping basket and going home with it. Book Off reports the firm's used game sales have also been strengthening, including those for the Famicom's successor, the Super Famicom, Super Nintendo as we know it. Sales of such games increased by nearly 60% in the year to May. That was last year, May 2023, from the previous year, it said. It goes on to read, customers say that they are drawn to the game's nostalgic soundtracks and low-resolution graphics, and some of them, well, they enjoyed these games as children, and now they want to share them with their own children. Nothing wrong with that. So a retro resurgence is happening in Japan, but I'd hazard a guess that they actually mean in mainstream Japan, because Japan, of course, is well known for its retro gaming stores, and I know plenty of people who like to visit, empty suitcase in hand, in the hope of returning with a cheap collection of PC Engine games, or some Sharp X68000 parts that would otherwise cost a small fortune over here. Nothing new about that. Also, this tallies with increasing reports of the popularity of retro arcades in Japan. An example that I read about recently was called Retro G in Tokyo's Akihabara, where there's a floor dedicated to games such as Daytona USA, Outrun, House of the Dead, and Street Fighter 2. And popped a link there for Duncan to put in the show notes if you want to read about that specific story. It comes as no surprise that a country steeped in video game history should want to celebrate it, and those who grew up there should feel nostalgic for it, nor that they have the skills and the manufacturing ability to knock up a super cheap console that's compatible to revisit the gaming past. Although the article doesn't use the word Famiclone at any point, which is exactly what these are, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I wonder if they even are the same Famiclones that were made in the past, just repackaged.
Well, they got single chip, didn't they?
Yeah.
So, you know, unless they can make that chip even cheaper, it's pennies. It's pennies, and there's probably more spent on the plastics that surround the chip than the chip itself when it comes to a modern-day Famiclone. I also don't think that this is a story that's come out of the blue. It's not a sudden surprise to anyone that Japan loves retro gaming. And the article isn't written in that way. It used to be that we'd see articles about this topic in a way that suggested it was a surprise. It was a bubble. It was an anomaly. It was odd that people might want to go back and play retro games, and it would never last. But I think the mainstream attitude as a whole continues to shift to accepting that retro gaming is here to stay, that it should be celebrated, and that it's simply a facet of video gaming as a hobby. And that's a good attitude shift. I hope we continue to see that. Dave, say something enlightening.
I'm pleased to hear about a retro revival in Japan, and I certainly understand why people will go back to these older games, because modern gaming has its issues, and these issues are just not there. If you put a cartridge in a slot and turn it on, then you're playing a game. There's no DLC, there's no bits to buy, there's no gold coins and gems, and you're not enjoying this properly unless you buy this extra bit. So it's nice that that's not there. I am, though, a bit surprised that there's little talk about Japan in the retro world. We have our little circles, and I know that it's even just down to time zones. There's a US and there's a UK retro world, and they're a little bit distinct from each other, although they do have an overlap. But I don't often hear about Japanese stuff. I don't hear about Japanese made devices for our retro stuff. It's easy to find stories about closures in Japan too. I googled just to make sure, and the first hit I got was from 2022, and it said, well, many gamers are still mourning the loss of two massive Sega arcades that closed down in 2020 and 2021. Another beloved arcade in Tokyo's Electric Town is now set to permanently close this September. So this seeming revival here is coming on the back of a huge contraction on the Japanese arcade scene. So does this mean that they've passed the lowest point and things are turning around now? Were they premature in closing them down? I don't know enough about it to say.
Or perhaps a contraction of a more traditional business model, a more traditional arcade style, and then the growth and revival of arcades around a slightly different approach, be it museum, be it embracing retro, be it setting the expectation that you're coming here to play old games, not that you're coming to an arcade and, oh, that's disappointing, there's old games there. You're going there specifically for that. So, yeah, hopefully that continues and people continue to embrace retro wherever they are in the world. You can read about this story, the other ones that we've mentioned, and a whole lot more in the show notes, which Duncan diligently updates. So go and check out the links there. And if you've got any similar stories or you want to pass comment about anything in Japan, maybe you live in Japan, it'd be great to know if we have any listeners based in Japan or on an extended stay there who can give us more of an insight into what's happening over there. You can find this story at reddit.com/r/thisweekinretro, where you can leave a comment or you can submit new stories that we can talk about in future shows.
Dave's housekeeping. Last week, we covered the Yuzu debacle. Is that the right word for it? Catastrophe? Calamity?
Depends which side of the fence you were on. If you're now $2.4 million better off, you probably wouldn't call it a catastrophe.
I'm surprised how well the internet in general has taken the Yuzu thing. So if you didn't catch last week's show, or you're not aware, Nintendo forced the closure of a Switch emulator and were paid $2.4 million in an out-of-court settlement by it. And I'm surprised how well the internet's taken it. It looks like people, obviously, they're not happy an emulator's gone, but they understand why once they see the amount of money that was changing hands on it. I think people have settled on this, okay, that was wrong.
And it hasn't entirely gone, because being an open source project, of course, other people have compiled that source code and given it a slightly different name. So it is still out there, just perhaps without the community that was surrounding it, where there are rumors that current games, ISOs for current games, ISOs for as yet unreleased games were being shared behind this paywall of a huge amount of money. But we covered that last week, so we won't get into the nitty-gritty of it again.
But yeah, there's not been a big argument about it. There's not been a fight between people who say this is terrible and people who say it's not. I'm surprised by that. But there's a story on Nintendo Life about a Game Boy emulator developer permanently removing the app from the Google Play Store. There's an explanation from the developer, and it boils down to this sentence: my family comes first, and for this reason, I've chosen to prioritize my family over the development of my apps. It doesn't mention Yuzu, but with the timing of it, you can't help wonder if that's someone saying, look, I don't want to be under Nintendo Spotlight. Last week, we predicted that we didn't think this Yuzu thing would have ripples in the retro world, so perhaps we were wrong about that one. I'm not sure.
And of course, you know, we've seen that there's been a payout. We've seen that the website's been taken down. What we haven't seen is whatever other things Nintendo have stipulated as part of this agreement that perhaps can't be talked about. So, you know, maybe there is a commitment that's been made to never work on that kind of software again or something like that. We just don't know.
There's lots more talk about Alan Sugar and Amstrad. We hope something comes out of that. I really don't think it will, though. I think he just wants to use the name for clout for his new venture.
Yeah, Amstrad Digital, which looks like a marketing company run by his son.
Yeah. And a preview of the Atari 400 Mini has appeared on Retro Recipe. So Perifractic has got a prototype. It's not in the final colours. He's talking about it rewinding games. He's very impressed with it. He talks about how the interface is improved and the stick is better from the Commodore releases, so they were obviously looking to improve on that.
It's we're guessing that the innards of these things are all identical and it's just prettied up in different cases for different systems. And if that is the case, it'll be interesting to see if any of these improvements do filter down as firmware upgrades to older products or if they're just left as they are. It would be nice. It would give a lot of confidence in the products if you see older products being supported in that way.
Yeah, it would also it would mean you would think, well, I'll buy this. The price does come down on them though. The price is it's incredible really how little you have to pay for it.
Well, if they can sell them for £20 in Japan, it tells you something of how much it probably costs to produce.
Yeah.
Other briefs this week, Calvin Harris has been seen at the Brit Awards. We had two submissions of this story from Classic League and Evan B. Thompson. Thank you for submitting these pictures. It's a video actually. He's seen using an Amiga 1200 with Optimed at the Brit Awards with Ellie Goulding looking on, lured by the power of the Amiga. That is the power of the Amiga, Dave. If you whip one out at the Brit Awards, world famous superstar singers will flock around you and show interest. And it just goes to show, Dave, that the Amiga is not dead yet.
No, it's back from the dead. CRG has submitted a Rob Smith video. He's got a little cool magic trick where he's got an Amiga onto the internet without adding anything to it. I want to tell you what it is, but I'd ruin the surprise, and that's not fair in the video. So the only cure is to watch his video.
Yeah, it is.
I also wanted to talk about his latest video, which should go public around the same time as this episode. And it's an Amiga project I've had an eye on for a long time. It's not one I can actually use myself, as my own Amiga has a PC power supply in it. So I won't be buying it. But it's one that I thought was really fascinating. It's called the Power Shark. And it's a very small device that fits into the square power plug on the back of your Amiga. It's not very much bigger than the original connector. It takes a 12-volt USB-C power supply, and you'll need to make sure that your USB-C power supply can do it, because not all can. And from that, it supplies the 5-volt and minus 12 volts and checks the 12-volt to the Amiga. I actually saw the appeal in this being a very cheap way to replace the horrible, unreliable, inefficient, old, massive Commodore bricks, thinking that there's loads of these USB-C PSUs out there. But sadly, the price is much higher than that, so it's not going to be the cheap go-to thing you would grab for every Amiga. However, what Rob has done is some testing on it to find out if it's up to the task and how good it is and how well it copes with things going wrong, and it came out very well.
Yeah, the important thing is that it's safe. The added bonus is that it's very space-saving, and that very chunky power connector on the Amigas really works well here, because if it was just a little barrel jack, you'd be worried about it flapping around or snapping off, but that can just chonk in there, and away you go. So it's well worth watching the video if you want to find yourself on Fascination Street.
It's got a switch on it as well, and that's what the Amiga didn't have, a power switch. So it adds a power switch to your Amiga. But it's 70 euros.
There was a switch, but it was on the brick.
Which was a foot warmer, I thought you said.
Yeah, on the brick, on the PSU, on the foot warmer, there was a power switch.
Right.
But yeah, you'd have to lean under your desk. So presumably this is then just at the back of your Amiga.
That's right. That's right. €70, though, so it's not cheap.
Very good. Pajaco has submitted the story that Digital Eclipse have tweeted that their Jeff Minter Games compilation / Doco Mate includes a resurrected demo of Attack of the Mutant Camels, R.A.P. Chris, for the unreleased Konix multi-system. Remember that? All the hype around that. I remember there being pictures of Jeff Minter in the full sit-in Konix multi-system because there used to be a seat with all the peripherals around it. Never got to see the light of day. Anyway, this unreleased game, as until now, is a Defender clone. And by the time you're watching or listening to this, the Doco will be released. I think it's on Steam. And let us know if you've watched it and if you enjoy it.
Dr. Local has let us know about DOS being 2.5 being released. I knew nothing about this other than a brief look says it's for a Raspberry Pi and it takes you straight into DOSBox at boot and it supports ScumVM. So this looks to be an all-in-one solution for it that runs on a Pi, which is a great idea. I'll need to look more into that. Sounds really interesting.
Yeah, the last time I explored using a Pi as a DOS-based PC was a Pi 4, and I would say I was getting around about 486SX25 speeds. Sometimes a speed burst, sometimes slower than that, depending on what I was doing with it. So I really would like to go back and explore all of this on a Pi 5, and DOSBian sounds like a good way to do that. We've had another story submitted by Unique, who mentions, well, this is a bang-up-to-date story, but it...
Unique Ask.
Unique Ask is the username, sorry, yeah. Not just Unique, Unique Ask. They've submitted the story that PlayStation 5 owners are losing access to hundreds of games that they might have in their library. At least 50 owners have reported that their digital games are going missing. So I don't know if that is a glitch in the system. Oh, it is. You know more, Dave.
Yeah. So it's one of these headlines that makes people click. It's a bit of a clickbait headline. It's not because everyone's worried that your digital purchases are going to be taken away from you.
Right. So as soon as you get a whiff of it, you're going to start. Yeah.
This is a bit of a clickbaity story. Everyone is desperately worried about PlayStation removing games from their libraries that they paid for. And PlayStation did try to remove digital purchases, but relented after pressure. And what's happened here is not seemingly them doing that. It's a glitch in the system, which hasn't been, as we're recording, not yet been fixed. But everyone is running with the headline, PlayStation digital games removed. So it's not quite that end game, worst case scenario that we all fear.
PlayStation owners clutching at their pearls. It would never happen on Steam, would it, Dave?
I'm sure it has happened on Steam.
It would never happen on Origin.
No, because it's shut. It's now...
It's already happened. You've lost access to your Origin games.
It did happen on the Intel platform, but they refunded me.
Oh, very good.
So I bought Angry Birds on the Intel platform to play it on the computer.
Oh, Angry Birds.
Before I realised...
Stop there, Dave. Just stop
before
there.
Before I realised that Angry Birds was a game of luck and played it for, I don't know, 20 minutes and that, forgot all about it, and then years later, they refunded me in full because the platform had failed that badly and they were shutting it down.
Well, you can read about this story and a whole lot more over on our subreddit, reddit.com/r/thisweekinretro. Let's get back to the meaty stories, story number 3.
Deep in the Australian outback, a new VHS rental store has appeared. It's actually not true. I don't know what counts as the outback or not in Australia, but since the ghost of Chris isn't with us, I'm going to assume that Melbourne is not in the outback, and in fact, if anything that counts as the outback wouldn't have shops in it.
Does that mean it's in the out front?
Yes, and it's in the out front.
Out front, Melbourne.
Yeah. The in front. Outback... In front,
right.
Yeah. But it is a new VHS rental store. And actually, it's not that either. It's an art exhibit. But it's designed to be as accurate as possible, even with wear and tear and fake insects in like fittings. Thanks to Christ of Why Don't You for submitting this Guardian article on it. It's called Videoland, and it really does look the part. Bold, garish 90s styling red, orange, blue, and lots of VHS tapes. In fact, it looks a bit like the fictional arcades we see in TV, in that it's more real than real.
The mythical VHS store. Because I don't remember dead insects in the lights of my VHS store. And I'm going to hazard a guess that, as this is an art installation, there's not any fake insects. There's probably flickering fluorescent tube lights.
Yes.
And that sort of thing. Yeah.
It's more real than real to get you to get the feeling it looks real, if that makes sense to you.
Yeah.
But seeing the images did take me back, though. It does look good.
It's an art installation. It's to invoke a emotional reaction to make nostalgia happen and make your brain produce whatever it produces when you're feeling all cozy and nostalgic. That's what it's all about, yeah.
Lilt. Yes.
Original flavour.
Quattro, that's
Quattro.
It.
Quattro, oh. Bass Shandy.
Pacers. The truth about it, though, is it's not got anything for rent. You can't take any tapes away. You can't watch the films in it.
Not even Mad Max?
No. Ugh. No. I don't think a VHS rental place would be a success these days. Do you think, Daniel?
What kind of a question is that, Dave? Do you think VHS rental would be a success? Yes, I do, actually.
You're an idiot.
I am, yeah. But here's my pitch for Netflix, for Amazon Prime, whoever wants to pay me for this idea. You set up a VHS rental store like this one. You put RFID tags in all the video boxes. You take your video to the counter. You scan your membership card, because remember, you have to have remembered your membership card, or you have to annoy the employee to look you up on the computer and check that you haven't already rented two videos too many. They look you up. Your video choice is scanned, and then it gets added to your Netflix account for 2 days or your Amazon account for 2 days. I call this P2 DVHS, physical to digital VHS rental, Dave. Yeah? So you said
it's not VHS, though. It's not VHS. And that
okay,
was the point.
Okay, let me expand on the idea. You get a VHS quality digital copy on your Netflix account. And you're not allowed to watch anything else at the end until you've rewound it.
What about you've got an app on your phone that has a tracking knob on it?
Oh, yes.
And you have to adjust that.
Yes, and a play and a pause. There's previews to other upcoming movies. There's trailers of that period in there as well. Look, if you did this as a pop-up, it would get lots of marketing coverage. It would be a good idea. It would be fun to get people to enjoy the nostalgia of the video store. They might even buy some popcorn or some wine gums while they're there. Or in the case of my old VHS rental store, they had a single wall, a very small selection of budget video games as well. And then later you could rent a PlayStation and a light gun, which I used to often do. So I think it would be a good fun pop-up, but no, I don't think there's any longevity going back to your original idea of a permanent VHS rental store, Dave. But Amazon, call me.
I think maybe a kind of DVD Blu-ray place might come back at a stretch. Mm. And certainly the browsing experience could be something we want. I think maybe somewhere that had these mountains and mountains of junk now that people don't want.
Yeah. I mean, be honest, if you want to buy a DVD or a Blu-ray, where do you go, Dave?
Amazon.
Oh, charity shop. They still exist.
I was going to say, yeah.
They still exist on the high street. Yeah.
Well, if you want secondhand ones, you go to a charity shop, but the curation there is not very good.
True.
So what they could do, perhaps, is have a curated video shop, just like you would see back in the day. You would take it to the counter, and they would give you one of the hundreds of thousands they've got in the back.
Well, here's another idea. All these charity shops up and down the country, let's just pick Cats Protection League as an example. They have charity shops up and down the country.
Supercars 2.
Supercars 2? Oh, yes, yeah. Getting told off by the Animal Protection League for answering the questions wrong. Yeah, that's a very niche reference there, Dave.
I knew you'd get it.
What if they all sent their VHS tapes, DVDs, all of that media to one shop, and you had one central VHS rental store for charity, and people would make a little pilgrimage to go there, and they would buy things, and everyone would benefit. How about that?
My killer idea is to do it in cinemas. So you've been in the cinema, you've seen a film, and you go to the cinemas. Have got lots of space. You go to their video shop in there. You're not going to walk away with anything digital, just like your idea, but you'll have an app on your phone that reads QR codes, and you can go and browse through hundreds or even thousands of VHS or DVD size boxes, because a DVD cover is about the same size as a video, a VHS, and it has the same information on it. You can browse through hundreds of thousands, split into sections, and you can find all you find out about the film is what you see in your hand. And you can then scan the QR code on the app, and that somehow ends up with a list of films to watch and ties in with streaming platforms so they can monetize it. So not too dissimilar from your idea, but put it in a cinema where you know people already like watching films.
Oh, I see. So you're just browsing and you're just saying what I might like to watch in future. I wondered where that was going. Is that, how are you going to have 50 people choosing what film to watch in the same cinema?
No. So it's just a place where you get people that like watching films. To go out, they've just seen a good film and say, well, why not go and choose films you might have missed to watch at home on your streaming platforms. I don't know, but it all comes down to trying to get that experience back that we miss, which is picking things up and looking through shelves and seeing what catches your eye. I'm not saying that what we have now is worse, because it's not worse, it's better, but there's little bits we miss out on.
Yeah, you can expand on this idea to so many things. You could do it with Steam. You could say, give me a video game shop on the high street with physical boxes that I can scan, and then that gets charged and added to my Steam account. Fun idea. But unless the existing high street retail model was accepted as a relic, which we will get there, but we haven't got there yet, and we accept that it's being trounced by online shopping, and then the rent and the business rates reflect that, that's never going to happen. Maybe one day it's more likely that shops will just be turned into residential properties and landlords will make their money that way instead and sell them off or rent them. But, you know, you could do it with other things. You could have an R price or an HMV, although HMV is still going in some way or another. I think it is, isn't it? There's still a store or stores. But you could have a more traditional, a retro R price or HMV. Browse, listen to music, tap it, add it to your phone. Surely Apple could do that when in their Apple stores, you know?
It feels to do it now, you would be catching a falling knife. You might be better waiting until all this settles down on the high street and find out what's left afterwards. But maybe in our lifetimes, we'll see something like this come back, a place you can physically browse through things, or maybe it'll just be done through VR and AR.
You know where you can do it, Dave?
Where?
At the Cave. Come to retrocollective.co.uk to book a ticket to visit the Cave and browse my fake retro store.
This cheesy advert was not intended, but I mean, it is what you've done. I mean, you've got, for people who are not aware, Neil has built a WH Smith style 80s computer game shop where he's got lots of games you can pick up, and he's even got a scanner. You can play the games by scanning the barcodes on them. So he's thought about something similar to this.
That just ties us back to the original Australian VHS store being an art installation. That's why I say very much about the emotional response.
Yes.
And that's what I tried to create in there, to really overwhelm you with nostalgia and really try to take you back. And I would like to see lots more examples of that on the high street, in museums, wherever else. I love that out-of-body nostalgic experience. Time now for our question of the week. And when we review last week's question of the week, I can see a note from Duncan. He says, I'm washing my hands of this question. This is all Neil's fault. So God help us what we might find in the answers here, Dave. The question was, what is the most fun you can have with a floppy disk? Size or capacity is non-specific. What's the most fun you can have with a floppy disk? I genuinely haven't read the answers yet, so let's click into it. Have you taken contest mode off, Dave?
I'm just about to hit the button. I'm just about to slam us out of contest mode.
Let's have a dramatic sound effect there, please.
Dun, dun, dun.
It is done. So let's check the top answer. Top answer is from Happy Coding ZX, and they say, I know Neil said only one drive, but I still feel the need to shout out the Floppotron and the ridiculous evolution it underwent. And then he's posted two links, started like this, eventually became this. So the Floppotron is the floppy drive that, well, multiple floppy drives, and then combined with scanners, with dot matrix printers, with other physical devices to play music. Yeah, that is a lot of fun. I think that's a good answer.
We missed that last week. I'm surprised we didn't mention that.
However, Tungsten Orchid replies with a very valid point. The Floppotron doesn't use any discs. It just uses the drives. Happy Coding ZX. You have been eliminated.
He does say, he does come back and says the music is stored on a single floppy drive that's then used to control the drives. And I imagine the drives have to have discs in them to allow them to make the seeking
tones. They don't have to have discs in them, but okay, we'll let him back in. Entry reinstated because a floppy disk is used to store the data in one drive and then all the other drives are controlled. Okay, fine. Oh, I was going in a bit harsh there, wasn't I?
Pre-Flim says, as a high school kid with an Amiga, like some of my friends, the inevitable playground clashes broke out from time to time. The most fun I had with a floppy back in the day was getting my sweet revenge on a bully. Said bully wanted some games or else, so I gave him some generic-looking backups to play. A few days later, he's moaning to his bigger boy friends that his Amiga won't load games anymore, completely oblivious that I tip-X the word high on the surface of the 3.5-inch floppy, which was Escape from the Planet of the Robot Monsters.
If a worthy sacrifice.
I assume he loaded it in at some point, coating his disc heads with a powdery layer of Tippex dust. Thankfully, he never put two and two together. Bullies never the smartest, are they? And I dare say it was okay after a thorough drive clean. All rather childish now, I think back about it. I'll shut up now.
Yeah, never mess with a nerd. We'll always have the last laugh. Lord Borak 316 says, me and my brother used floppy disks as death disk frisbees. That was pretty fun until someone caught a 3.5-inch to the eye. Not to the knee, to the eye. Lots of other great answers from Tech Made Easy, who talks about the Dayglo Neon floppies.
Oh, yes.
Session Pristine talks about his 386 and buying a bag of secondhand double density discs for down the market, bag of 50, and what he did with them. Mystic Greg. Retro Dawn, I Am Amiga, Kickoff with four friends and my homemade joystick splitter. Do you know, I didn't know Kickoff could be played four player. I
thought it was. Yeah, you can get four teams in the pitch at once.
Four teams on the pitch at once?
No. No. Just controlling two different players.
Canon Soccer, Fuskit talks about. So many answers. Oh, Rob Smith is in there. He says, Disc Fight?
What?
That's the most fun Rob Smith can have with a floppy disk is to have a fight with disks. Oh, so many answers. Frisbee. and then Snoopies rounds it off with the most fun I had with floppy disks were with the free AOL and Prodigy online service disks that came with magazines so they could get their free 15 or 30-day trial before moving on to the next free trial to get onto their BBS systems. Excellent. Dave, what should we make our question of the week this week?
If you went to Japan, what would you like to bring back?
Fantastic. Preferably retro technology, but, you know, have some fun with it. Thank you, as always, for taking the time to listen to the show. I hope you've enjoyed it with your cereal if you're listening on a Saturday morning or whenever you listen and wherever you listen. And I will say again, it was nice in that story to learn a little bit more about Japan and the Japanese retro scene. We have so much more to learn. So if you're there or if you're at any other part of the world and you'd like to let us know that you're listening from there, please do go to the subreddit, reddit.com/r/thisweekinretro, and share your retro joy, what you've been up to, where you are in the world and how things are maybe a little bit different. Just educate us because we're all here to learn and to embrace and share this hobby together. Thank you again to the new patrons who joined this week. Did we mentioned them, didn't we, in house?
No, I've just remembered that we didn't.
Who are the new patrons this week, Dave?
So we have four new. Are we going to insert this back in as if I did it right, or are we going to do it in
no,
the end?
No, we'll go out fluffs and all.
Okay. So four new patrons, thank you very much for joining our Twirler program. Andrew, Stephen, Dave, and David.
Thank you. You all have a license to twirl now. Very much appreciate your support. If you'd like to support the show, head to patreon.com/thisweekinretro. Participate at our subreddit. Subscribe to our YouTube channel as we try to get to 10,000 subscribers. Just search for This Week in Retro on YouTube. And we'll see you again next week. Dave?
There was a suggestion that to celebrate 10,000, we do a live show from my house.
Oh, from your house? I'm perfectly happy to come up to the outback rather than you coming to the in front at the cave. Whatever works, Dave. That's fine. He's waving. That means it's time for me to wave. See you next week, everyone.
Bye. Waving.
Bye.
This Week in Retro was presented by Neil from RMC The Cave and Dave. It was produced by me, Duncan Stiles. The podcast version of the show is available through your favourite podcaster, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And the video version is available on the This Week in Retro YouTube channel.
Join our community subreddit at r/thisweekinretro to suggest and vote on the stories we cover on the show. If you watch This Week in Retro on YouTube, please give us a like and subscribe to help us reach new viewers.
If you enjoy our show and would like to support it, then please check out the link to our Patreon page in the show notes or description. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time for more up-to-date news for out-of-date tech.